You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, kōkasta tōku ingoa, no maharamai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rahina Monday. I'm your host Caster and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in the studio by producer Alex. If I can, coming up on the show, for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party, I spoke to MP Simon Court about Labor's proposed streaming levy and recent IT issues in the health sector, including the Manage My Health data breach and the IT outages last week. I also spoke to Professor of Law at the University of Auckland, Jane Kelsey, about the World Trade Organization and its future as the United States becomes more isolationist. Thursday Wire host Caden spoke to Samira Qureshi, women's rights advocate and researcher on social movements and civil society in Iran, on the nuances and current political situation following a week of mass demonstrations and government crackdowns. Alex, what have you got for us today?
I spoke with senior lecturer in political science at the University of Otago, Robert Patman, about Donald Trump's threat of tariffs on major EU member states over their opposition to the potential of the US taking control of Greenland, and what it says about Trump and what it means for the EU and NATO.
He aha o whakaaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395, or wāia mai rānei, give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Kawa e warawere e ahana koutou te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrero anō, hei pakehere rokiroki mā runga i te pai tukutuku o Erirangi Poho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more as always by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Now let's get into the show.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court.
Last week, the Labor Party announced plans to put a levy on large streaming companies if elected. This levy would fund local TV and film projects, which the party says have seen significant cuts in recent years. The ACT Party criticised the policy, claiming that the levy would be passed directly onto consumer prices. I also asked, in our weekly catch-up with ACT Simon Court, I also asked about the state of tech in the health sector, given the Manage My Health breach and multiple IT outages last week. The government has been criticised for cutting funding to IT services, leading to fewer workers and inconsistent systems. For our weekly catch-up, I asked about each of these issues, beginning with Labor's proposed streaming levy. I wanted to talk about the streaming levy first that Labor's proposed. They say the revenue will go into local productions, with the levy being applied to organisations like Netflix. What's the ACT Party's take on this policy?
Well, we don't believe that making New Zealanders pay a tax on services that they like watching to fund services or fund production that they haven't chosen to watch is the right thing to do. It will simply mean higher prices for viewers, because companies like Netflix and like so many other streaming services, you know, Amazon Prime and all the rest, thousands and thousands of shows, movies you can watch at any time with the click of a button. And people are making those choices every day. They're already deciding what to spend their entertainment dollar on, and we don't think that adding a tax onto people's existing choices is the right thing to do.
Balancing this out on the other side, though, we've seen a lot of cuts to local screen production, and Labor's obviously offering a way to address this. How does the ACT Party plan to address, you know, cuts to local screen production and improving our local contributions, I guess, to TV and cinema?
Look, there's lots of opportunities to see New Zealand culture and New Zealand programs on television or on TVNZ On Demand, TVNZ Plus and others. It's out there if people want to watch it. But if New Zealanders are choosing to watch other channels, other sources of entertainment, there's not really much a government can do at the margins, particularly when it comes to taxing people or, you know, adding a surcharge onto somebody's Netflix account to fund production here in New Zealand that New Zealanders are not telling us that they want to watch. It doesn't make any sense.
In the ACT Party press release, we saw some criticism of Labor for wanting to fund programs like Celebrity Treasure Island or the documentary that came out about Jacinda Ardern. Are there any problems with productions like these?
Well, I think when celebrity Treasure Island is inviting sitting politicians like the Labor deputy leader Carmel Cipollone to come on the show, she was taking time off her parliamentary duties firstly, that was a problem, but it does risk politicising the way that your public funds, taxpayer funds, are spent on New Zealand culture, New Zealand history, on things that it's important to record and document in New Zealand. The Jacinda Ardern documentary, the Chloe Swarbrick documentary, which apparently was slated for release over a year ago. No one's seen that yet. I think it's incredibly unhelpful when New Zealanders' taxpayer funds are directed into political projects.
I wanted to return a bit to that Treasure Island comment. You talked about Carmel Cipollone appearing on Celebrity Treasure Island. How different is that from ACT Party leader David Seymour appearing on Dancing with the Stars?
Well, there's not a call right now for David Seymour to go back on Dancing with the Stars. He's actually threatened some of his MPs, me included, that if we muck up, that's where we'll end up. So, look, from an ACT Party point of view, if screen companies want to do this kind of thing, that's fine, but we shouldn't be taxing New Zealanders' Netflix accounts. We shouldn't be taxing their Amazon Prime or their YouTube subscription to pay for shows like that.
Moving on to the health system outages, we saw the Manage My Health breach earlier this year, and it's highlighted some issues in cybersecurity in the health sector. Is the government taking steps to ensure an issue like this doesn't happen again?
Yeah, we certainly are, but just to be clear, there's a couple of health IT issues which relate to two separate events. One is that cyber breach you referred to involving Manage My Health. It's a private patient portal. It's not a system run by Health New Zealand. And core services like My Health Account and My Health Record, which are Health New Zealand services, were not affected. But what is the government doing about it? Well, in November of 2025, just about 6 weeks ago, Health Minister Simeon Brown announced that Health New Zealand is going to make a major investment in cybersecurity, particularly in the stabilising critical systems. When this government came in, we discovered that Health New Zealand had 6,000 IT systems across their organisation. That's essentially one IT system for every 15 staff. It beggars belief, but it shows you with an underinvestment, a lack of focus over many years on health infrastructure, health information technology, that's where you get to. So what the government is doing, modernising the health IT system, digitising it over a 10-year period. First phase, like I said, stabilising those critical IT systems, making sure data's protected, and modernising the platforms, and then enabling those innovative health models that put patients first. Each phase will build on the previous one. In the next couple of years, Kiwis are going to see massive benefits when they go to their doctor or if they're referred for additional tests or if they do end up needing surgery for some condition. It's going to be seamless, whereas at the moment, 65% of all the directions are still paper-based.
We've seen some claims and accusations that the Manage My Health hack happened due to poor security at the organisation, which came from time-saving and cost-cutting measures. Can we trust private organisations like this to handle sensitive information when they also have these profit incentives?
Well, if you bank in New Zealand, you're probably banking with a private company. So I think there's an example of how the private sector can protect people's data. Of course, every day they have to be vigilant against cyber threats, against hackers, against attacks. And if their business is managing sensitive patient information and health records, then the onus is on them to protect that information. If Manage My Health want to be considered as a competent supplier, then they're going to have to make sure that they demonstrate that. It's not a private sector, public sector thing. I mean, the police in New Zealand have lost a whole lot of people's records about what firearms they own that ended up basically as a shopping list for criminals recently. So, it's not a public or private thing. It's just really, really important that people's personal information is kept safe.
Moving on to those other outages you mentioned earlier, the IT outages in the health sector last week, is this a sign of a developing problem?
Look, they were temporary IT outages at hospitals in the southern and central regions, and during those outages, staff were able to use those backup paper processes so care could continue. But, you know, as I pointed out, this government inherited 6,000 IT systems across Health New Zealand, and so, you know, there is a big investment program. It's not going to happen overnight, but we certainly recognise that changes need to be made in the digital infrastructure and digital architecture that our health system is reliant on. So, look, it's not perfect right now. We've inherited a mess, but we're certainly working on a strategy to recover that.
We've seen the government make some cuts to the IT systems and IT projects that you mentioned there. 136 at Health NZ cut in late 2024 to save money and to condense systems. How does that, are those cuts at all linked to the outages we might have seen last week?
Oh, I've seen no evidence of that, but you know, you talk about late 2024. Well, 6 weeks ago, Health Minister Simeon Brown, having done the policy work and having developed the project, announced a 10-year program to replace these 6,000 digital systems, to consolidate them into a much more refined, robust and secure system for managing patient records, patient information, all of those interactions between GP, between specialists, between and hospitals. It's going to focus on remote patient monitoring to support earlier discharge, a national radiology system to prioritise urgent cases, and stronger cybersecurity, as I pointed out, to protect patient information. So, you know, so that is this government's focus. It is going to be expensive, and it's going to require having the right people in the right positions to deliver this program.
That was the ACT Party's Simon Court speaking to me about Labor's proposed streaming levy and IT issues in the health sector.
That was Simon Court from the ACT Party.
So it's a very odd time to be alive, as they say.
The Wire.
Iran's population are currently experiencing a state-imposed internet and communications blackout following mass demonstrations against the government. I spoke to Samira Gureshi, women's rights advocate and researcher on social movements and civil society in Iran, about the nuances of the current political situation. Gureshi spoke to me in an independent capacity. I started by asking if she could talk about what sparked the current wave of mass protests.
Oh, it's so hard because I know that we hear mainly that this was only the economic reason for the protest, but actually it's really the protests in Iran have really long history. It's decades of protests. I always say that we cannot even look at any of these, you know, social movements or events just in bubble or in silo. We really need to look at the context. Yes, that was because serious economic crisis and recession, economic recession, and sudden, actually, you know, give an example, like before, during the Islamic Revolution or before the kind of during that time, so in Iran, they could have $7 for $1, seven toman, that is Iranian currency, for $1. So I just say approximately, but now actually suddenly jumped to about 147, 150,000 toman for $1. So it really clearly tells you a serious economic situation for sure. We know that that was the spark, you know, like the reason, the first reason. And the uniqueness of this protest was that because it was the economic phase that started, these protests start from bazaar, which is historically really kind of, it has a really symbol. So maybe not like old days, it's still important in terms of political economy of Islamic Republic, but we know that it has a symbolic position because they're mainly conservative groups, but also that traditional role of bazaar. So bazaar started these protests, but then without doubt, we know that most of these protests in Iran tends to different demands, because particularly freedom, democracy, call for really dignity, you know, because for decades they have been denied for these basic human rights. And every time, so something that I always ask people to pay attention really to, even they talk about Iran and these type of protests and movements, is first we had, especially since 1990s, we had a student movement. And then always these protests face, you know, violent, oppressive, you know, violent oppression, you know. So student movement, we had it, and most people, you know, media, they hear from a student movement, big movements in 1999, I think. The next one they talk about it is 2009, but actually I've lived in Iran. So between this time, we had so many other protests every time during a student movement. During the student day, we call it 16 Azar. It's one of the months in the Iranian calendar. For a student day, we had different campaigns, different wars, and all of them during the 8th March, every time women activists, they had different gatherings for International Women's Day, 8th March, but all of them oppression. And then we had 2009, a big one, which was more around the political rights and the fraud in the election. And then again, between 2009 to 2022, that we talk about Mahsa Amini, we had different demonstrations, different protests. We had 2019. We had so many of labor, actually, strikes. We had a truck drivers strike. We had, again, so many of these protests, and all violent crackdown. One of them, they call it Bloody November 2019, because the level of brutality and violence they used to oppress those protests. But again, now we see another one, which is now started end of 2025, which was even bigger than the last one.
So, I want to ask a question on that note, yes, of the intensity of the crackdowns. Iran is currently under an internet blackout. What does this mean for the people living there right now?
It's really difficult, actually, because, it's exactly darkness, because it's not just it's not a new tactic by Islamic Republic of Iran. So especially from 2009 Green Movement, they find out about the power of citizen journalists. Many of the videos went out, so they started, even they didn't, after that Green Movement, they don't let foreign media coming easily and having journalists. So technically there hasn't been any kind of independent media or any media. Like, it's really serious oppression when it comes to the media space. But they, after that time, they found that actually one of the important things is they need to cut these connections first, because the videos will go out and the evidence, so they can it would be hard for them to deny they use violence against their own people. But the other things is also, they have this kind of, these Western media are brainwash our people, and then, you know, these kind of things now, because that's a good excuse. They say that these people come to the streets. It's not new, actually. This time they say that they are spies of Israel, of Mossad. So in the past, we had, again, the same. I live in Iran, and I remember that even I was kept questioning about how I pay for my university. And it was during the time that a couple of students who study overseas, they've been arrested and in prison under the name of, because they had a scholarship, they say, you're a spy. You're a spy. So that's not a new tactic by Islamic Republic. And now with the role of social media, they need to change these tactics. And this time, very different, because everything is cut. Like, even I could have, after a couple of days, I could have a really quick chat with my family in Iran, that even text messages internally, they couldn't send any text messages to each other internally. So it was completely cut from sideboard. But also, even within a country, it was not easy to contact each other. I think it's a very terrible feeling. I just imagine myself being there. It's like definitely you're like in prison and now not even allowed to visit or have a phone call with your family. It's hard, really. I don't know. I cannot find any word to describe it.
I want to ask more about the tension between Iran and the idea of Western interference, because right now we know the United States is saying they will intervene in Iran. Is this something that the people who will be affected are supportive of?
I'm so happy that you asked this question, because it's really, as someone who I've been obsessively following different social movements in Iran, even in my research, I even somewhat lived there and going to these demonstrations and protests and in movements. It really breaks my heart in different ways. So something that I just thinking how it's possible that one thing I feel that it's unfortunately the social media and algorithm. So unfortunately, people are getting all this information from social media, and I would really be I'm worried about this. But also, I feel that why we cannot think about different nuances, why we always think that things should be either or, you know. When it comes to Iran, we need to be very, very careful how we analyze and how we portray these kind of movements in Iran, because there are different things that we need to consider. So imagine, I told you, it's not new, just the level is different, you know. I work in, I don't want to use this example, but, you know, I work in particularly in the field frontline with family violence. We know that every in this interpersonal or system level, when you face violence, when people face violence, they resist that violence. Every time with the form of resistance that people show, that perpetrators, they also change their strategy and make it worse and worse to the extent that you really are you're entrapped. And this is the situation of Iranian people. So in different ways from decades ago, particularly from 1990s, they really try different ways to resist this form of violence, to call for their freedom. But unfortunately, every time the way that they got this dictatorship bond to these demands is even worse and more violent. So from one tactic, remembering that every time that there is a protest, they try, the Islamic Republic of Iran, try to promote this propaganda that we are very good country, we have a government system, we respect our citizens, everything is fine. But these people actually are a spy of Israel or United States. So don't forget that the doctrine of Islamic Republic is based on these enemies. These are our enemies. So they have, the Islamic Republic have some like a foundation to live. And these foundations, one is that mandatory hijab law. The other one is this claiming that they are anti-imperialism, which is a really empty claim because they are Islamic capitalists. So it's very different. So please, I get angry when people think that Islamic Republic is really kind of genuinely anti-imperialism. It's not, because they have to define themselves in this way against US and Israel, because that's the foundation of their life to stay here in power. So when there is protest, on one side, the system use it and they try to promote this propaganda to really technically delegitimize or get that credit from these people, and then good justification to violently oppress them, arrest them, kill them, disappear the bodies, and so many terrible things. And then on the other side, we know that there is no doubt. Why not? Yes, that's the reality. Many of these powerful countries, particularly like U.S., like Israel, they are waiting for this kind of, you know, movements, particularly in Middle East. They hijack it. Like, I don't know, like the people of Iran, they're outside, they're already protesting. And I don't know if you follow some of these tweets, on X, some of the official of Israel saying that our Mossad agents are on the ground. So technically, because they are it's a power game between Israel and the Islamic Republic, and in between are the people who are dying, you know. So they say that, our Mossad agents are on the ground. But then technically, actually, because they want to say, look, we are so powerful, we are there, we are active, we are arming your protesters. But actually, the reality then is Islamic Republic have even more power now. Best evidence to say, look, I told you, these are the agents of Mossad agents, so I can even execute them all under the national security. So the other side, what we have nowadays, is very far left that unfortunately, I think they are really away from some of the foundational values of the left. So I don't want to generalize left. We have so many school of thought on the left. But in general, some of those far left, that they see every of these kind of, you know, look anti-imperialism, thinking that, anyone against Israel and U.S., they are anti-imperialism and we should praise them with no critical thinking. This is dangerous. This is against the foundational values of the left. So again, what they are on this side, the far left is doing, so they say that, you know, these are all the plan of Israel, of U.S., because Islamic Republic is anti-imperialism. So what is happening technically? Again, they also give good reason for Islamic Republic to continue this execution, this killing, this disappearance of the dead bodies. And technically, all of them together further entrap Iranian people in this situation, in this violent situation, but also they also get away the agency of Iranian people and completely denying decades of social movements in this country by the people, very homegrown, and cuts. So many cuts. We have so many political prisons now in the prison. We have so many people that they lost their life all these decades. This is not okay. I tell the people on, I would say far left, because we have so many people on left that actually they also support people of Iran, and they don't see any kind of binary. They can support any form of violence in this Middle East, particularly they can criticize Israel, they can criticize United States for all those mess that they are doing in Middle East, and particularly genocide that is happening in Palestine, in Gaza, particularly. You can condemn that one. You have to, actually. But because it's about humanity, it's about justice, it's about equality, it's about being against any form of injustice, systematic violence, and hierarchy. And in Iran, you can also support people of Iran and their movement for democracy and freedom.
That was Samira Gureshi, women's rights advocate and researcher on social movements and civil society in Iran, on the nuances of the current political situation following a week of mass demonstrations and government crackdown.
Is it too late in the process, though, to change that?
Nothing's too late, bro. Everything's made up in politics.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. Text in your thoughts 5395.
Garth! Where's your hat? No hat, no play.
I don't have one, sir.
Then go on and pick a hat from Lost Property.
Oh, sir, those hats all have nits.
It's nits or melanoma, Garth.
It's a no hat, no play summer. So it's lucky 95BFM have you sorted with sweet merch for your noggins. Choose from four designs, two classic cap designs, one cord design, and a bucket hat. Pre-order yours now from twotonesmerch.co.nz.
The world-famous True School Hip-Hop Show.
Thursday nights, take a deep dive into all things hip-hop with BFM's True School, checking in on current and historical flows, beats, and grooves, both local and international. A Radio B institution spanning decades of solid cuts, and the one show to know.
We like the breeze, float straight out of our lids.
True School Hip-Hop Show.
Keeping you clued in on what's fronting in the world of hip-hop.
True School Hip-Hop Show.
Who you calling the bitch?
Thursdays from 9 to 11 p.m. with Get Ban, Luz, Max, Barry, and Eve Love in the area.
On 95 BFM.
I believe in, like, the solar system. I believe in space. I really do believe in space.
Spaced Out. Josh Aoraki from Auckland Stardome Observatory and Planetarium talks everything spacey on Spaced Out. 4:40 every other Tuesday.
Presently, I clamber in the chamber, the flailing of my ailing limbs. Looks like a very good
know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. That was Mount Maunganui by What Kind of Human Have I Become.
Is the plague at all a threat in the modern day?
No.
The Wire. This weekend, Donald Trump announced his plans to levy tariffs against European countries who oppose his plans to press for Greenland. The move, which is an attempt to levy America's economic position to dissuade what has been fervent European opposition to his desire for the territory, has been met with severe responses from Europe. With the EU threatening retaliatory tariffs and the ties between the US and the rest of NATO increasingly fraught, serious concerns and questions are being raised about how the US view Europe and their allies under the Trump administration's America First agenda. I spoke with senior lecturer in political science at the University of Otago, Professor Robert Patman, about these threats and the European response. What exactly has this threat from Donald Trump covered and entailed?
Well, Mr. Trump has made it clear for a number of years, I think going back to 2019 during his first term, that he saw Greenland as important to the United States in terms of national security. He doesn't spell out the other reasons so candidly, which is questions of Greenland's huge rare earth minerals, which are available. And there is something of a sort of geopolitical race now for many competing powers in the world for access to rare earth minerals, which are often key in the high-tech race that many countries are engaged in. But so... at least theoretically, Mr. Trump's view is that America needs Greenland for national security reasons. He says that Denmark cannot protect Greenland against threats from China and Russia. But you see, Mr. Trump's logic doesn't have much to sustain it. Firstly, Denmark is a member of NATO, and therefore Greenland, as an autonomous region of Denmark, is subject to full NATO protection, including from the United States. And the second reason is Mr. Trump is saying that he worries about Denmark being unable to defend Greenland against Russia and China. And yet Mr. Trump has absolutely no qualms about Mr. Putin invading Ukraine, and it's, and Mr. Trump has confirmed that he believes that the victim of aggression in Ukraine, which is Ukraine, the country has been illegally invaded, he believes he is the cause of the war there. So, in short, Mr. Trump's position is very confused. There's a third factor which we haven't mentioned, and that is that under a treaty signed in 1951, America already has a base in Greenland, and under that treaty, it can expand the number of bases it wants in Greenland. In fact, during the Cold War, it had up to 17 bases in Greenland. With the end of the Cold War, that number is steadily reduced to one. So under that treaty, Mr. Trump is able to satisfy all security concerns that he's articulated. So it's quite baffling. And then the question comes on, well, I suppose the question comes down to whether you believe the real motivation for this is not security, that's a smokescreen, but is to ensure that an enormous but thinly populated territory like Greenland has such mineral wealth that Mr. Trump wants to make that, he wants to extend American ownership over that to ensure that America can sustain its dominance in the world.
And with all that said then, does this threat itself represent a continuation or the natural endpoint of Trump's posturing geopolitically, or does it kind of feel like a contradiction for what he's trying to do in the world?
Well, Mr. Trump often contradicts himself, and he often says different things on different days. I would say his foreign policy is incoherent at the moment. On the one hand, he presents himself as a close ally of Putin and then worries out loud that Mr. Putin's a threat to Greenland. If he really had the excellent relations that he says he has with Putin, why is he so worried about Russia and Greenland, particularly since that territory is already subject to protection? So, quite frankly, the idea that China and Russia is deeply preoccupied with the war in Ukraine, that they're a threat to Greenland, doesn't really hold water. It seems to me that you could say this is a continuation of his America First agenda internationally. Remember, Mr. Trump has always been sceptical about NATO. And what he has done is create a crisis within NATO by imposing tariffs on 8 key members, European members of NATO and the EU, for resisting and showing open opposition to his illegal claim to Greenland. So in a sense, I see this as very much all Mr. Trump asserting America First at the expense of international law and at the expense an alliance which the United States has led.
On that, obviously, you know, Greenland does not exist in this vacuum. It's under Denmark and it's a part of NATO and the EU. Yep. What does this threat, especially of tariffs, say about the US's outright relationships with Europe?
Well, Mr. Trump and his aides are privately contemptuous of liberal democracies in Europe. And again, it comes down to the fact that the EU is the only actor in international politics that has the heft to stand up to multinational corporations and high-tech corporations. For example, it stood up to Google, and it's also fined Google, and it also fined Apple. When these multinational companies, high-tech companies, are so powerful that most nation states, including our own, would be outgunned in terms of wealth and probably wouldn't be able to stand up to pressure from them. You have 27 countries in the EU pooling sovereignty, and therefore forming quite an effective deterrent to multinational companies, which are largely US-led. That is, that you look at Elon Musk, you look at Bezos in Amazon. And Mr. Trump doesn't like an environment in which they're restrained in any way. So, in a sense, I think that what it says is that Mr. Trump, his view of the world is quite different from any other president in the post-45 period. And I think, quite frankly, Alex, people in our government and in many liberal democracies need to start looking at Mr. Trump with very clear eyes, because this is not an administration which shares the values of this country or its interests. It doesn't believe in a rules-based international order. Mr. Trump's made it quite clear he will not be constrained by international law. His vision of how the world should be run is a global hierarchy led by the United States and supplemented in a concert of power by other great powers such as China, Russia, India and Japan. That's how he believes there should be five countries running the world, with the United States at head of the table of those five. That doesn't leave much space for middle powers or small powers like New Zealand. So, you know, it's what does this tell us about Mr. Trump? That his vision of America's future as a sort of global hegemon, that's how he sees it. I'm not saying that's the reality. I think it's far from the reality. I think he's influencing his understanding of what to do. The problem for Mr. Trump is, both in South America, following the intervention in Venezuela, but also in Greenland, is that people will not accept this sort of back-to-the-future 19th century view of how the world should be run, and continuous resilience. And one thing we haven't mentioned, Alex, is the domestic opposition in the United States to what Mr. Trump is proposing in Greenland. Some Republicans have said that if he proceeded to use coercion against Greenland, then he could be subject to impeachment. So, and also public opinion polls in the United States indicate there's virtually no support for what he's proposing to do with respect to Greenland. And so, in a sense, he's skating on thin ice here. He's imposing tariffs against the EU, but the EU, or members of the EU is the world's largest and most prosperous single market. He runs the risk of retaliation, which could effectively shut American goods out of Europe.
You've covered a lot there, but looking at these both these threats of sanctions and the sanctions themselves, if they come into being, or sorry, the tariffs and sanctions, looking at both the EU itself with the potential they floated retaliatory tariffs on over 93 billion euros of US goods, and looking at that internal opposition or the Republican Party themselves and countries like us, kind of on all of those, what reaction can we expect to see from these tariffs? Is this threat likely to succeed in deterring the EU, or is it just going to galvanize opposition?
I don't think it's going to work, to answer your question. I don't think the tariffs are going to intimidate. I think, you see, come back to your earlier question, the moves in Venezuela and now the move on Greenland, having come out of a clear blue sky, most liberal democracies, including our own, for the last 12 months have persisted with an approach, a softly approach to the Trump administration. That approach recognised that most liberal democracies disagreed with Mr. Trump, but they hoped by flattering him and taking a really constructive approach to anything he proposed, that they would moderate his policies and coax him into a more moderate position. What has happened is quite the reverse. By not speaking their mind on crucial international issues, Mr. Trump has doubled down on his demands. New Zealand, for example, didn't express solidarity when he threatened both. The New Zealand government, back in the early part of this year, last year I should say, did not express solidarity when Mr. Trump territorially threatened Canada as well as Greenland. And I think many New Zealanders were uncomfortable about that. But the idea was, and you can understand it on one level, the New Zealand government thought, why provoke him? Let's keep our head beneath the radar, and that way we'll avoid some of the worst tariffs that may be distributed. But it didn't work. We got landed with a 15% tariff, which was a travesty. So I think there's now, come back to your question, I don't think the tariffs will work that Mr. Trump is proposing, because it will face considerable blowback. At the end of the day, to take measures like Mr. Trump is proposing, he would need overwhelming domestic support. He hasn't got it. It's a bluff. And the Europeans are very well informed about American domestic politics. They will know how weak his position is, and they're not in a mind to give way. They're pretty furious with Mr. Trump over his stance towards the Ukraine. They haven't said that publicly, but there's no doubt about it that Mr. Trump consistently takes a pro-Putin position, and again, a position which is inconsistent with international law. Mr. Trump seems to be completely unaware that Mr. Putin's invasion of Ukraine is inconsistent with key principles of international law. He may be aware of it, but he doesn't care. So that's caused considerable anger, but it does set the scene for this confrontation now that's unfolding. And I do not believe the Europeans... It's telling that someone like Keir Starmer, who's taken a tremendous amount of domestic criticism in the UK for kowtowing or toadying to Trump, has now said that Mr. Trump's imposition of tariffs and his threats against Greenland are, in his words, completely wrong. So this is quite tough language from a country which often is seen as America's closest ally. So Mr. Trump is risking a lot with this. He's got no strategic reason for taking this action, not strategic in the sense of security, but he may have a strategic reason in the sense that he wants to get his hands on, or America wants to get his hands on, the resources of Greenland. That won't wash with most countries in Europe. After all, if Mr. Trump got away with that, what's him to stop him putting in a bid for buying the South Island of New Zealand, or the North Island for that matter? It creates a shocking precedent, a grave precedent in international politics. And so New Zealand, as well as the other liberal democracies, I don't think are now in a mood to keep trying to compromise with Mr. Trump on this issue of Greenland.
That was the University of Otago's Professor Robert Patman on Trump's tariff threats towards the EU over Greenland and what it means for America, Greenland, Europe and the rest of the world.
The Wire. Their relationships with their girlfriends or their wife. No one, they shouldn't have more than one wife at a time.
The United States is increasingly moving away from global institutions in a pursuit of populist isolationism. In its wake, it leaves multilateral organizations founded on the assumption of US support, which many smaller nations are dependent on for foreign affairs, health support, defense, or trade. The World Trade Organization is facing such pressures now, with a looming threat of US exit following similar policies curbing the organization's influence. To discuss what the WTO is, how dependent it is on US support, and what it could mean for a changing global society if the US withdrew, I spoke to Professor of Law at the University of Auckland, Jane Kelsey. So to start us off today, I guess for people who don't really know that much about it, what is the World Trade Organization and what does it do?
As part of what we here talked about as the rules-based system that operates in the world, one of those systems is the rules by which countries trade with each other, and that's meant to enable countries to import and export stuff without taxes or other obstacles into and out of other countries. Now that sounds very, very dry, but in reality the World Trade Organization, which runs the system of rules, is kind of a big global constitution that is mainly in the interests of big companies and big countries. Little countries like New Zealand rely on those rules for things like exporting our dairy products or other things into other countries and not facing big taxes and obstacles. And that system has been in trouble for a long time, and it's coming to crunch point now.
And what kind of systems, I guess, keep the WTO in place?
The WTO is a bit like the United Nations, so it's got over 160 countries as members, and in theory, every one of them is equal and has the same leverage to get what it wants. But in reality, this system of trade rules has been written and rewritten over centuries by more powerful countries. Initially, you know, the rules were less formal because they were the colonial powers saying what the countries they colonised had to do, and that was always in the interests of the colonising state. Usually they got raw materials that they imported and made the value add of back in their own countries. But more recently, it's been from the mid-1980s, been remade by countries in what we call the neoliberal model, which is governments hands off and let corporations and so-called markets rule. And that benefits the big corporate players, not just in areas like agriculture or industrials like making motor cars, but the US insisted that there also be rules that allowed its big entertainment companies, pharmaceutical companies and so on, have protections for their intellectual property, protections for investments in other countries, protections more recently for the big tech players on data and so on. So it's kind of a global set of rules that is run by an institution that in theory everyone is equal, but in practice big countries and their companies are the ones that benefit from the rules.
And the US has had a big role in shaping how the WTO operates, but recently it's been pulling away from multilaterals and similar organisations. What's the balance like there?
Well, the irony is that the US in the 1980s, when the negotiations happened setting up the World Trade Organization, set the agenda and everyone basically jumped to it. So what it's been operating on since the mid-90s, when the World Trade Organization was formally set up as an institution, the US thought would work to its benefit. Now it's decided that it doesn't work to its benefit, partly because China, which the US was keen to bring into the WTO, has actually blossomed, and the US says, oh, it hasn't broken the rules and the situation's not working, and so we need to change the rules. But also that neoliberal model, the model where the rich got richer and the corporations got richer and all of the safety nets for ordinary people were stripped away, has created a domestic backlash in the US as well. I mean, that's the kind of populism you see supporting Trump, but also the populism you see in other places, the protests against these big agreements and so on, including here on the TPPA. And so the US has said, oh, this doesn't work for us anymore, so we want to remake it. And this is how it has to be remade, so it once again serves our interests as the biggest player in the world. And if you don't like what we're doing, then there is kind of a veiled threat that it'll pull out and collapse the whole thing.
And do you think that's likely? I mean, multilateral organisations collapsing without US support. We've seen the UN struggling a bit financially in the past year. We've seen the WTO looking shakier. Do we think these multilateral organisations will continue to have US support and without it will continue to exist?
Well, we've already seen the US recently pull out of over 60 international organisations. It hasn't pulled out of the WTO. What it's done instead, its representative to the WTO in December circulated a memo that basically said, this is the way the rules have to be rewritten, otherwise the WTO will become even more irrelevant. So they've got a ministerial conference coming up in Cameroon in late March, and the question's going to be, are the other countries, including New Zealand, going to jump to Trump's tune, or are they going to push back against it to defend the system that is clearly currently failing, or are we going to have a discussion about something else? Our government is very much in the, oh, let's try and rescue the system, because we're still a very neoliberal country that doesn't think easily about new ways of doing things. But it's important as well, I think, to mention one other thing, which is that whilst we're all very focused on Trump and Trump throwing grenades into international organisations, the US has actually been white-anting the WTO now for the last 10 to 15 years. So it's completely disabled the court system and the WTO by refusing to appoint new judges to the appellate body there. So that's dysfunctional. It's stymied a new round of negotiations that were supposed to benefit developing countries. It's, as we've seen, not just with these Trump tariffs, but earlier ones, that Biden continued disobeying some of the basic rules about how you impose those kind of tariffs. And it's even demanding, and has for a long time, that a special rule about national security is completely self-judging. So the US can say, this is a national security issue, no one can question it, and so the whole so-called rules-based system goes out the window. That's not just Trump, that's been happening for some time. So what we're seeing is the extreme version of this, where Trump is not even pretending any longer to operate by the rules. And that poses for countries like New Zealand and others who are deeply embedded in this so-called rules-based system a massive challenge.
And obviously there's huge risks with the WTO potentially going away, but you also mentioned the flaws within the organisation, and especially the flaws that have come from the US taking such a leadership position there. Is there an opportunity here for rebuilding global trade and rebuilding these relations from the collapse of an organisation like the WTO in maybe a more equitable way and maybe a way that benefits growing nations more?
The most certainly is that opportunity. The difficulty that we have is that governments are... How do I put it? Governments are so deeply embedded in the thinking of the last 30 years, and certainly ministries like our Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade and our both our trade minister and the opposition's trade lead trade spokesperson, to get a debate even about something different requires a recognition that the current system is broken. And so getting to that point is critical. And in my sense, the ministerial meeting in Cameroon in late March of the WTO is going to be a litmus test of whether they are prepared, in fact, to see that that's an issue. For some countries, poorer countries, they are subject to extortion by Trump at present anyway, with him slapping on tariffs for everything. And that's even affecting now the EU, with anyone who opposes his plans for Greenland and a whole range of other areas. So there needs to be a zero-based first principles rethinking. But whose first principles, whether it's indigenous peoples and people who are dealing with the climate crisis and people who are dealing with poverty, whether their interests are going to underpin those first principles, or whether it's going to be the same kind of corporate and commercial interests, is going to come down to us and what kind of questions we ask and what kind of alternatives we make as a baseline for supporting politicians.
That was Professor of Law at the University of Auckland, Jane Kelsey, speaking to me about the World Trade Organization's changing role as the global world order shifts.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi kia koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rahina Monday. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. The ACT Party's Simon Court, Iran Civil Society researcher Samira Gureshi, Senior Lecturer in Political Science at the University of Otago, Professor Robert Patman, and Professor of Law at the University of Auckland, Jane Kelsey. Nei rā hoki, te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is The 1 to 4 with Penny.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.